The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, earlier this week, I spoke to Housing Minister Dara O'Brien, who outlined his new affordable housing plan, which would see the state take a stake worth up to 30% in a home. But is this plan a viable solution to the housing crisis? And if not, what alternative measures can be undertaken to resolve the ongoing crisis? Well, to talk about all of this, I'm joined by architect Mel Reynolds, former environment editor of the Irish Times, Frank MacDonald, and Hugh Brennan, CEO of O'Cool & Co Housing Alliance. Good morning and welcome to you both. So let's just get your take, first of all, on the minister's scheme. Mel, what do you think?
Good morning, Pat. The scheme is this is a strange one. It looks like it's very much modelled on the shared ownership scheme that's been in the UK for some years. It's quite small, like 75 million, just doing some of the maths here before it came on. Won't get you that far in terms of numbers. 30% equity share, if it's 100,000 a house, it'll do 750 homes, or if it's 2,000 houses, like the minister has suggested, it'll be 37,500. So it's not huge and seems very tentative. The sort of failures of this in the UK have been highlighted by analysis over there. I think the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee did a report in 2019, and they said that somewhere in the region of 50 or 60% of those who availed of the loan didn't need it. And
there's an earlier... has put no income ceiling on this particular scheme. All right, we'll come back to you on other topics. Frank MacDonald, does it make sense to you?
Good morning, Pat. I don't think so, because subsidies like that effectively prop up higher house prices. And I think they'd reinforce the upward trend we're seeing now in spite of the pandemic. But, you know, whatever it costs taxpayers, the money would be much better spent on actually building social and affordable housing. And the same goes indeed for the first time buyers grant.
Yeah, it turns out in a Freedom of Information request that was given to Sinn Féin TD Eoghan Brin, their housing spokesperson, that senior officials lobbied against this, saying that it would push up the price of houses.
Well, exactly. This is the kind of stuff that is proposed by the Construction Industry Federation, the CIF, and because of where it comes from, it's inherently suspect, because the CIF really acts in the interests of house builders and property developers, not in the interests of prospective homeowners or renters. So, you know, I think that, you know, it's always depressing to me that when a government or a minister takes on board an idea coming from that vested interest.
All right. And Hugh, what do you make of the scheme?
Yeah, good morning, Pat. I'm, you know, in agreement to a certain extent with both Mel and Frank. It just depends on how it's going to be managed. If, for example, you have a private developer building, and if an individual can go to that private developer and say buy a house for 400,000 when they only have means for 280,000, and if the local authority take the share in that house from the private developer, that certainly can only push up prices, and I wouldn't be in favour of that at all. If, however, what happens is, and what is happening in some of the other local authority areas, is that the local authority themselves devise a affordable housing scheme, and they will take an equity share in the house based on the market price. So we hope to be involved in a couple of those where we will actually sell the houses for X, and then the local authority will take a share in that. That won't necessarily push up houses in the private market. It still, for me, is absolutely not my preferred way to go at all, simply because you're not selling a house that is really at an affordable price. I mean, the person is paying essentially the market price, or maybe slightly under the market price with the local authority model. But they pay their first mortgage up front, and then they have the equity share to be paid back over time. It's either sold or paid back when the house is sold, or It's let run for 40 years, but it has to be paid back within 40 years.
In simple terms, this analysis suggests it's just a way around the central bank rules. It's deferred borrowing.
That's what it looks like. Absolutely, you know, that's what it looks like. I mean, you could have just gone to the central bank and say, look, what we want to do now is we want to use 5 times the income instead of 3.5, and we want to extend the loans for 40 years. And the central bank would have said no. And I'm maybe in a minority, but I actually approve of the central bank's macroprudential rules. I think that they work well in my opinion, and they shouldn't be changed. But yeah, you're right. That's the effect.
Yeah, so it means you can afford it today, but if your circumstances don't change in 5 years' time, when you're expected then to fund this amount outstanding to the tune of 1.5%, you might find yourself in trouble at that point, not being able to pick up the slack that now becomes you become liable for.
Not only that, Pat. If, for example, we end up with another crash, and if, for example, that house that you bought for 400,000 and you're forced to sell it, you still have to pay back a proportion of that to the local authority. So say, for example, in our case, or say, for example, they buy the house, and let's say their initial mortgage is 280,000. And let's just say, for argument's sake, that the everything crashes and they only get 280,000 for the house. So they pay back their mortgage and that's it, but they're still left with this other lump of 100,000 to be paid back, you know, which is a huge burden to put on people. So, you know, I can understand, you know, how this came about, because I know that there was pressure from the construction industry to do this, but I don't think it's been fully thought out, to be honest.
All right. Well, we know that there's a shortage of supply. So why they would need to ramp up demand is another question. Mel, let's talk to you about social housing. The idea being, and Dara O'Brien himself said it, they don't want to go back to the old days where the state, through local authorities and so on, built massive housing estates, you know, blocks of flats in the Dublin area, for example, but housing estates in Cabra, Drimna and so on, in order to house the populace. Is that where we should be going?
Oh, absolutely, it is. No question about it. We know that there's been a number of reports now between their IG's department in May 2018 did a report on rent supplement versus local authorities building direct. They reckoned at that stage it was twice the cost in areas of high demand like Dublin to enter into rent assistance rather than to build directly on their own land. More recently, the Society of Chartered Surveyors in Ireland came out with a report on housing costs, and they reckoned it was around 140 to 160,000 euros per dwelling cheaper for local authorities to enter into these simpler arrangements where they effectively develop on their own land. So no question, in terms of value for money, it's a complete no-brainer to build on their own land, and they have an abundance of it. The unfortunate thing is that all the numbers are going in the opposite direction. We know that the total number of actual local authority direct builds in 2019 was a little over 1,000 dwellings. And in Dublin, County Dublin, the four Dublin local authorities is 228. So the total nationwide of output was lower than the year before, lower than 2018. And the output of the four Dublin local authorities combined is less than what was built in 2017, believe it or not. In 2017,
so we're going in the wrong direction.
So the numbers, despite all the rhetoric, they're going absolutely in the wrong direction, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what builders can do is, of course, they can do the building. Local authorities can't, so they employ builders. Frank, what do you think it is about local authorities that they don't really want to get their hands dirty in this area anymore?
Well, they effectively got out of direct building on a large scale of housing in the 1980s under the kind of when Pádraig Flynn was Minister for the Environment way back when. And under the kind of whole Thatcherite idea of leaving people to buy houses rather than rent houses from a local authority, and a lot of the housing stock that the local authorities had built in places like Merino and Drimna and Crumlin and Kimmage and Cabra and so on were sold off at bargain basement prices to their previous tenants.
Okay, but Frank, really it's not simply, you know, the idea of bricks and mortar. It's also to do with social stability. Home ownership seems to bring with it a social stability. People mind their own houses better than they mind the local authorities' houses.
But the broader picture really is that the government's Rebuilding Ireland programme, which was launched in with some fanfare several years ago, has really been a failure because year after year it's missed its targets for the number of houses to be built, whether social, affordable or private sector houses. And the bulk of the money that should be invested in social housing has instead been spent on public subsidies to private landlords. And that includes, say, something over €250 million a year is spent on housing assistance payments for essentially high-priced accommodation that's pretty well insecure, rented from private landlords. And, you know, like when I go back to when I was in my 20s and indeed when you were in your 20s, both of us bought houses in Harold's Cross, and could easily afford to do so. I think you bought a house on, your first house was on
Lower
Kimmage Road. Number
15 Lower Kimmage Road, famously.
Yeah, and
yes.
I was around the corner in Casimir Road. And you know, at the age of 25, I managed to buy a four-bedroom Edwardian house, an end-of-terrace house on that street, on a standard salary with a mortgage from the EBS. Now I live in an apartment in Temple Bar where I've been living for the last 25 years, and it's about 124 square metres, which is large for by any standards for an apartment, and it's all paid for. So all of us who are in our 60s or 70s now are in a privileged position compared to the younger generation. And I think really fundamentally what we have done is the older generation really has totally betrayed the younger generation when it comes to housing, because not only are younger people in their 20s and 30s locked into paying high rents, you know, 1500 or 2000 a month for a one or two bedroom apartment, they can't actually save the money for a deposit, never mind fund a mortgage.
All right.
And the whole system really is stacked against the younger generation.
In terms, though, of the council's building, we saw the row recently with the Dublin City Council where, they voted against a particular scheme, and the cost of that scheme seemed remarkably high, because I brought to the attention of the minister the other morning, Sisk Living in 2018 delivered homes with an average price of just under 178,000 in Talla. So it's doable at a price. I don't think the construction inflation has raged too much higher in the last couple of years. Hugh, is it possible for local authorities with the proper mechanisms to build social housing affordably?
Of course it is. And there's no reason why they shouldn't use the likes of Sisk Living and get Sisk Living to do it, because Sisk Living are builders and contractors, and all they want to do is to build and to leave a good product behind them. You know, they've built their reputation on that, and they will continue to build at those kind of rates, Pat, if the local authority bring them on board and do it on local authority land. You know, if Sisk are not the developers, and they don't want to be the developers, if they're not looking at getting the land and selling the houses afterwards, if they build for the local authority and then the local authority have an arrangement to either provide social or affordable and even some private on the site, Sisk Living and other contractors, smaller contractors, will do this all day, every day, and it will reinvigorate the construction industry, but it'll reinvigorate the smaller contractors, and that's what we really need to do. And I would love to see local authorities even dividing up some of their sites and bringing on board a number of smaller contractors. They will deliver those houses. They will deliver them at that kind of figure that you're talking about, that Sisk Living can do it at. They'll deliver a top quality product, and you will be able then to provide affordable housing for people without having all of these really unnecessary schemes that are really only going to push up the price of housing.
Now, some people point to co-living as a way of getting a lot of accommodation up very quickly. Most of it, of course, well, all of it is for rental rather than for purchase. But Mel, your take on co-living. You know, there is a place, obviously, for single occupancy apartments for the student body and so on for a certain time in your life, maybe. But the minister said no to co-living, even though there, you know, are some underway.
Yeah, there's somewhere in the region of about 5,000 co-living units that either have planning permission or going through the system or are existing change of use applications that got permission. So there's a significant number of them out there. In terms of the actual space standards, I know there's a lot of debate about it. I would sort of be a bit more devil's advocate and say, OK, well, if you take on board some of the promoters positions on this to say they're giving it's a variety, it's a niche use, etc., say absolutely fine and say, OK, let's accept what we have here. And if they're effectively mini bed sits. But the unintended consequence of this use really in the broader context is the inflation of land and the preclusion of residential building on these sites. So the way to mitigate against that simply is to introduce a rent cap and say, OK, in every location specific, say, for example, it's done on a bed space way and say if a co-living scheme has permission, say in Dunleary, if the local rent there is 2,400 for a four bed space, two bed apartment, a single bed space co-living unit should be 2,400 divided by four is 600 euros per month. And that's a rent cap. And what you do is you very simply introduce rent caps in areas so that straight away eliminates the unintended consequence of inflationary effects.
And see how many of those schemes would end up being built. I mean, I'm looking, Frank McDonald, this morning, a report from about Barter Capital, who have lodged an appeal against Dublin City Council because they had insisted on the omission of 18 bed spaces from its 111 bed space plan for 98 Merrion Road. And one of their arguments was there'll be less demand for communal kitchens by residents because employers like Facebook provide meals in the workplace.
Well, come on. I mean, all sorts of arguments are being advanced by planning consultants and others to justify all sorts of shocking schemes. And by the way, it's not true that Dara O'Brien has banned co-living. He's basically attempting to curtail it to the supposed niche market that it's going to cater for, supposedly designed to cater for. So, you know, but I mean, we have to recognize that co-living is essentially a substandard form of housing because all you get to call your own, in effect, and it's for rent, of course, is an ensuite bedroom, you know, of 12 to 16 square meters with shared kitchen and dining facilities, and maybe there'd be amenities like a gym on site and so on. And Owen Murphy, the former Minister for Housing and Planning, famously described on News Talk co-living as being like trendy boutique hotels. But there's been a rush of co-living developments, as Mel has pointed out, since it became clear that Dara O'Brien was going to do something about it because he had described the whole idea as bonkers. But there's another model which is now taking over, which is build to rent, where whole blocks are being forward sold by developers to institutional investors, often from abroad, based on high rents. Because essentially what's happening is that Dublin and other cities in Ireland are being commodified for international capital investment with the government's complicity. And the real estate investment trusts involved apparently pay hardly any tax, if any, on their profits. And if you were to take, for example, the former DIT College of Technology site on Cavan Street, it's going to have 299 build-to-rent apartments, which consists of 130 single-bedroom units, 130 studios, and only 39 two-bedroom apartments. And, you know, this is a complete antithesis of what Dublin City Council adopted 10 years ago. Excellent design standards that required a mix of apartments in every development, you know, one, two, and three-bed units big enough for families and so on. But not long after these standards were adopted, the then minister in charge of housing and planning, Alan Kelly, who was now the leader of the Labour Party, started the whole process of dumbing down the design standards, again at the behest of the CIF, which had argued that the standards were too high and that it made housing schemes unviable. And yet more damage was done by Simon Coveney when he decided on a whim, apparently after listening to some developer moaning about putting forward the case about on the radio, to allow developers to bypass local authorities entirely and go directly to On Board Planola for any so-called strategic housing development with more than 100 units or 200 in the case of students.
And by the way, locally here, Frank, there are two developments going ahead, and you can hear the clatter of the rock breaking from 7 in the morning until 7 in the evening with no regard whatsoever to the local residents.
None whatsoever. But I mean, but Murphy, I think Owen Murphy did more damage than Coveney did by further dumbing down apartment design standards to facilitate build-to-rent and co-living schemes. Such that developers don't even have to provide any private open space, such as balconies, that you could sit out on for any of the units. And you think of how that would work if you were working from home with a laptop on the kitchen table or even in your bedroom. And also, because Murphy effectively abandoned restrictions on building heights, we're getting high-rise co-living schemes, such as the horrendous proposal for the Markets area that includes a 14-storey tower of co-living units right opposite the city's old fruit and vegetable market.
And Hugh Brennan, what do you make of co-living? Does it have any place?
Not for me, Pat. I'm afraid I know there's a talk, people working in the tech companies and that might appreciate it. Absolutely not for me, and not now with COVID and pandemics and that. And imagine, I don't know how many people they're saying should share a kitchen. I honestly think it's daft. The only place that I ever thought that it had any merit at all is like in a nurse's home, where the nurses are there and they're in working in the hospital next door, and they come over and they share a kitchen, and then they have their own rooms, and they're there for a couple of years. That might work.
The student accommodation which exists all around the city. Again, it's a rite of passage maybe for students going through this kind of experience, but it's not necessarily what you'd like for the rest of your life.
No, and it's certainly not. I certainly not what I would like for my children. Very little time for that kind of private developer led developments. And Mel is right. It's just pushing up the value for the land. That will have a knock-on effect in the local area. It's mad.
Yeah. Now, we see the surge in house prices, 6%, and, there are those who say, well, that's only the asking price, the real price is different. But when you see an increase, it's compared like with like, what it was last year, what it is now. So the asking price was always the comparator. So I don't think we should go down that route. Bottom line here, guys, is that the state has got to build more and more houses, either to help people long-term to purchase or rental forever, if that's the way people want it to be. That's the bottom line.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. And both of those are possible. It doesn't have to be one or the other. I mean, you can do cost rental schemes where the state will come in and they will provide some kind of a subsidy. We actually looked at one in Ballymun recently. We couldn't make it work if we had to have rents at 70% of the market rent, but we could at 80%. So in other words, if we were given a subsidy, we then could have done it at 70%. So it is possible for actually quite a small subsidy. And for affordable purchase for housing, it is cheaper to build housing than it is to build apartments. And that can definitely be done. And the long-term benefit of having affordable housing in any area is absolutely huge for the area, because people have extra disposable income to spend, and they tend to spend the most of that in their local area. Local authorities and the state will benefit hugely in the long term if they
Frank and Mel, I presume you both agree that the state getting more involved in this, whether for rental or to help people in some way to ultimately become owners of their own property, is the way to go.
Absolutely, Pat. We have the bizarre situation at the moment where local authorities are actually paying through the nose, up to €400,000 for social housing units in private sector to private sector developers, when they could be investing that money directly in building social housing like they did in the past, or funding approved housing bodies like O'Coolan to do it. But, you know, I think really fundamentally, and I don't want to sound like Donald Trump here, but the whole system has been rigged to suit the development lobby. And we've got to get off that horse because it's not going anywhere. And, you know, the whole idea of building sustainable neighbourhoods has gone out the door, you know, because they're shamelessly catering for what the market, the developers want, rather than what's
actually needed. Last words from you, Mel, the state?
I think it's, you know, the logic behind this is pretty straightforward. You were talking about the actual cost to build. The actual cost in Dunleary, Rathdown, all-in cost, including VAT, fees, levies, etc., land costs, construction costs, for a two-bed apartment in 2019 was €294,000. The same year, we've seen Dunleary Rathdown paying leasing Part 5 social units off developers. The price for that has doubled between 2017 and 2019, and the average price now is €2,400 a month. So it's the same. The logic really is, if you have a garden at the back and you have a site to build, instead of building, and if you own that site effectively for free, you have access to €200,000 to build at ultra low interest rates. Instead of doing that, you walk out and you decide to rent for €2,000 a month. So it makes no sense here. And I think
no sense.
Yeah, the political will, I think, really it boils down to there's official resistance to the state intervening in building, and affordable housing is a strategic threat to the development sector. I mean, if you can imagine, if O'Coolan set up an ad in the paper tomorrow for 1,000 three-bed houses in Shankill for sale for $270,000, they'd be sold out in an hour. But it'd be very hard for somebody next door to sell the same product for $470,000. So all of the levers of power will be pulled to try and get away from a meaningful affordable housing scheme that's being done on state land. And instead of that, we have a couple on 85,000 can afford 300,000. They're still 91,000 short of the average price of a home in Dublin. And this is the state's response is here's a second mortgage for 91,000 to buy that. So it's very
We will poor. Have to leave it there. Mel Reynolds, Frank McDonald and Hugh Brennan, thank you very much for joining us.